ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय नमो शिवाय कृष्णप्रसाद बुद्धले श्रीमद्भक्तवेदान्त स्वामिनि नामने नमस्ते सरस्वतीदेवे गौरवाणी प्रचारणे निर्विशेष शून्यवादी पाश्चात्यदेशतरणे श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिव श्री गौरभक्तवृंद हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे श्रीमद् भागवतम कैंटो 10 चैप्टर 45 वर्स 5 सावात Sambhava Deho Janita Poshito Yata Na Tayor Yati Nirvesham Pitror Marcha Satayusha Savata Sambhava Deho Janita Poshito Yata Natayo yati nirvesham Pittor marcha satayusha Savata Sarva Of all Artha Goals of life Sambhava Source Deha One's body Janita Born Poshita Maintain Yata, from whom? Not. Tayo, to them. Yati, one achieves. Nirvesham, repayment of debt. Pitro, to the parents. Marcha, immortal. Shata, 100 years. Ayusha, with a lifespan. Translation. With one's body, one can acquire all goals of life. And it is one's parents who give the body birth and sustenance. Therefore, no mortal man can repay his debt to his parents, even if he serves them for a full lifetime of 100 years. Purport, having stated, both you are parents, and we have suffered because of our separation, Krishna now states that he and Balaram's religious principles have been spoiled by their failure to satisfy their parents. Translation, with one's body, one can acquire all goals of life, and it is one's parents who give the body birth and sustenance. Therefore, no mortal man can repay his debt to his parents, even if he serves them for a full lifetime of 100 years. So Krishna here is speaking. According to the tradition in the Varnashram system, according to those rules, at the same time, he is the Supreme Lord, so he doesn't really have to follow any of the rules. Yet the nature of Krishna, especially, is that he follows the rules and he acts in such a way that no one can really detect that he is supreme. And therefore, people mistake Krishna for a human being. Now, of course, the scriptures do say that Krishna has Nara Akriti or Nara Rupa, that he has got a form of a human being. So they say, he's a human being. He's got a form of a human being. Or they'll say that, okay, yes, he is God, and temporarily he comes as Krishna and acts like a human being, and then he gives that up and goes back to his Vishnu form in the spiritual world. That's God. But that's also not correct. Those people who think that Krishna is a temporary form and Vishnu is the permanent form, those people are equally aparadis. Some people will say Krishna and all forms are illusion. Maya. And some people will say, well, the form of Krishna is like a human being, but actually God is something else. So that's also an aparad to Krishna. So yes, he has a human form, but that's not a temporary form. That is an eternal form. And it is a spiritual form. And it's not an act that the Supreme Lord puts on simply to satisfy his devotees, and after they're satisfied, then he disappears and says, ha ha, I'm actually God, and I've got another form. Now it is very difficult for us to understand how God can have so many different forms that simultaneously satisfy so many different types of devotees and still be one God. That's not God's fault, that's our fault, because we cannot conceive of the powers of God. If we try to do that, then we're more like a schizophrenic or something, you know, trying to be so many different personalities. And we can't do that and be one person at the same time. God can do that. He can be many. And he can also be one at the same time. And all those different forms are not superficial forms that he simply assumes and pretends. None of this is pretend. Sometimes, of course, it is said in the Bhagavatam that like an actor assumes different roles, so the Lord also takes these different roles. So it looks as if it's some sort of play that he's putting on, and then actually he's just playing a part. But that's not true. He's an actor in the sense that people can see that it looks like this. It seems that it is like that. But actually, Krishna is actually identifying completely with all these different roles that he plays. And it is most difficult to believe in Krishna because he plays the part of a human being more than anyone else, and he looks like a human being more than anyone else, and then all the other avatars and forms of God. Of course, we have forms like Rama, who are also human-like in many ways, and then he has two hands also, and has human form, not like Varaha or Narsimha or whatever. So he's also human-like. But Krishna is more human-like, or most human-like. In fact, he's the best human. He's the best of all the humans. Every good quality one could imagine in a human being is in Krishna, but minus all the bad qualities. So Krishna is the perfect human form. That form is spiritual. So the form, of course, is human-like, and the qualities and the activities are also human-like. This is what is so confusing, because yes, if he's a human form, Rama has a human form, but he does extraordinary things all the time. And then we can understand, he's God. And all the citizens of Ayodhya know he is God. Not so with Krishna. The people in Vrindavan never see Krishna as God. They cannot detect that he is God because of their love. Now, he will show, of course, sometimes he is God there also, but still, they don't believe it. And he makes it such that they won't believe it also. Why is that? Because Krishna's relationship especially, even his acts are extraordinary. His relationship is so more extraordinary that they can never believe he is God. So for instance, Krishna kills Putana. But of course there, no one can actually see how Krishna does it. But Krishna must do that because he's a big demon. He doesn't worry about himself getting killed. He never gets killed. But what about all the other children of Vrindavan? Putana will kill them. So he kills her. But he cannot do it because he's just a two-day-old baby, I think. 2 days old or so. 1 day-old baby. Helpless baby there. So what can he do? He can't do anything. All he can do is drink milk. So therefore, he drinks out her life air. He pulls out her life air with his lips. Sucks out her life air. So that is his power. But no one can see that. So they still think, he's a helpless child. And he was attacked by the demon, and somehow Putana died. It wasn't Krishna that could do it. It's impossible. It's a small, helpless baby. So like that, Krishna does many things. Then some people do see that he's actually doing something extraordinary. So when he was under the cart, and then the Sakatasura demon was in the cart, but then Krishna knew this demon was there, and he made the cart go a little lower, and then he pushed up his little foot, and when his foot hit that cart, it shattered to pieces, and everything fell off the cart. And everyone was astonished. What has happened? The child almost died by sitting under the cart there, and he couldn't do anything. He was helplessly lying there under the cart, and the cart fell over, but it didn't fall on him. And they thought this is something very strange. And the other little boys, they were saying, oh, we saw it. Krishna put his foot up, and he did that. And he kicked the cart, and it flew over like that. But no one would believe them. Huh? And how could his little foot, such a little foot, tender little foot, how could it actually move the cart at all, and how could it break the cart? Normally it couldn't, but Krishna could do it with his little foot. So no one really believed that Krishna did that also. So over and over again, Krishna did many things, and sometimes the cowherd boys would see Krishna do it, but parents would not believe that Krishna could do such a thing. Later on, when Krishna was with, grew up a little bit, and then one day, Nanda went bathing early in the morning, but it was the wrong time, according to the servants of Varuna. So they got angry because they're not supposed to bathe before in the dark, So they got very angry. Oh, this person is bathing in the river. And so they grabbed him and took him down to Varuna's kingdom. And when that happened, everyone was full of lamentation. They called for Krishna. And then Krishna dived into the river. And then he went down there. And then he went to see Varuna. And then when Varuna saw Krishna, then he assembled with all his people there. And he began offering obeisances and prayers. And Nanda Maharaj was also there. He was sitting there. Nothing's wrong with him. He's sitting there very comfortably. And he's looking at all this. All the devatas were praising Krishna and saying, you're the Supreme Lord. Like this. And Varuna says, this is such a nice opportunity. Now I can see you. My servants have made a mistake, actually. Then he released them. And then Krishna rescued Nanda Maharaj and they went back. And then Nanda Maharaj described everything to the cowherd men, and they had a big discussion. Well, looks like Krishna's God. Because all the devatas are worshipping him. And they discussed like this for a long time, and they said, Krishna must be God. And they said, oh, wow, this is so far out. Maybe we should ask him for something. And then they began to act like normal people. Which do we ask from God? So many of them said, well, maybe we should ask for bigger houses or better cows and this. This is not proper. let's go see the spiritual world. Show us the spiritual world. That was their final conclusion after everything. And so Krishna said, yes, I will show you the spiritual world. And sure enough, showed them the spiritual world. But what he showed them was Aishwarya, Goloka. Yeah, Krishna was there. And when they saw Krishna there, then they said, oh, yes, this is Krishna, Supreme Lord. And they were very happy. And Krishna was being worshipped by the Vedas and everything else like that in very great reverence. So they were happy because Krishna was there. It was a little bit strange, though, because it wasn't like Vrindavan. So they were happy because Krishna was there. And then Krishna suddenly took that vision away, and they were back in Vrindavan again as cowherd men. And they saw Krishna, and they were even more blissful. So then they understood that actually this is even better than seeing the spiritual world in Aishwarya Vaikuntha. And then they thought, no, Krishna cannot be God after all. They were worshipping him, etc., etc., etc. He showed us the spiritual world and only God can do that. And he was worshipped there by the Vedas. But it's impossible that he can be God because he's our son. And we raised him. He was born from us. And Mother Yasoda feeds him milk and he depends on us. So he cannot be God. And they forgot everything like that. So their relationship and Krishna's response to them is such that they never see Krishna as Supreme Lord. Even he shows it to them, they'll forget it immediately because of the strength of their relationship, which seems very different from seeing God. So that is the nature of Krishna, very, very mysterious. No one can really understand. And even the cowherd men and women don't understand. So In this way, Krishna is not playing a role. He's not pretending to be a baby for Mother Yasoda and take her milk, but actually doesn't need any milk, and he doesn't have to, because he's independent. He's Svarat. He's not playing a role. Huh? That's very difficult for us to understand, but this is the nature of the Supreme Lord. He has achintya shakti, or inconceivable power. And inconceivable power means that what is impossible becomes possible. And what is impossible? What does that mean? Things which are absolutely contradictory can exist within one object. Yeah? So if we say an object is hot, how can it be cold? Or if it's black, how can it be white? Yeah? And it's very impossible to think that. So we are chintya beta bade. If everything is one with God, how can it be different from God? It's a logical contradiction for us. How can it be? Or if the book is on the table, how can it not be on the table simultaneously? It doesn't make sense. So that's, but by, if we have a chintya shakti, then both things can exist simultaneously, two opposite conditions in one object. So Krishna has a chintya shakti. That is the nature of God. He has his power, and it is manifest most obviously in Krishna. Of course, all the forms of God will have a chintya shakti because they're all supreme. But it's in Krishna that this shows up in the most remarkable ways. So yes, God is independent, Krishna is independent, he's Svarat, everything. But in the form of Krishna, he shows complete dependence. Now, of course, in all forms, there is prema, and God becomes dependent on the devotee, even for Vishnu, in one sense. That Vishnu is in the heart of everyone, and when he sees the devotees, his heart melts. That's so for Vishnu also. He has prema, and the devotees in Dasya Rasa for Vishnu have prema, and the devotee controls the Supreme Lord to some degree. But for Krishna, this becomes extreme. The devotees have extreme love for Krishna, and Krishna has extreme love for those devotees. And therefore, the extent of control that the devotee has over Krishna becomes very remarkable. So that is exemplified by many of the pastimes in Vrindavan if we examine them. And we see how Krishna is completely controlled by the devotees. So Mother Yasoda takes Krishna as her small child. And a small child is dependent on the mother. Now Krishna is independent. He is Svarat. No one is above Krishna. No one can control Krishna. He is the source of everything. Everything depends on Krishna. Yet because Mother Yasoda has that love of Krishna as a son, then he also becomes completely dependent on her. And therefore, he must crave for her milk, and if he doesn't get the milk, he'll cry. Now, he's independent, and he, of course, in the spiritual world, there's no hunger and no thirst anyway, and Krishna is the source of everything, and he is self-satisfied, but he gets hungry for Mother Yasoda's milk. And he will never be satisfied unless he gets that milk. And so he'll cry. And God shouldn't cry also, because there should be no pain for God. Yeah. He is separated from Mother Yasoda's affection and her milk, and therefore he feels pain also. But God shouldn't feel any pain. So we see contradictions like that. And of course in the Damodar Lila there we see Krishna runs away from Mother Yasoda with his little feet. But he's only a little child, so he cannot run very fast. And Mother Yasoda can catch him because she's bigger. So he's running away, and then she is very... he doesn't have to run very fast, and she can catch him. But there the Bhagavan says, how is it possible that anyone can catch Krishna? Because God is beyond the greatest yogis who have the speed of the mind. In the cities, they can go at the speed of the mind anywhere, and they cannot find Krishna. They cannot even touch him. And Mother Yasoda can catch him with great ease. How is it possible that anyone can catch the Supreme Lord? And not only she caught him, she tied him up. And no one can tie up the Supreme Lord, because he is supreme, and he's the one that ties everybody else up with karma. Everyone is under the bondage of karma in the material world. And yet Krishna is also bound up, Mother Yasoda, tied to the mortar, tied with the rope. How is it possible? So how can the Supreme Lord be put in such a position? And no other form we will see that. We see that Vamana, he ties up Bali with the ropes of Varuna. He ties them up. But Krishna gets tied up like this. So it looks like a big contradiction. So is Krishna just playing a role? No, he's not playing a role. This is Krishna. But because of his affection for his devotee, he is exactly that form. And he's in that role. He identifies completely with that particular role. So he gets tied up. Why? Because of the love of Mother Yasoda. There's that question, how can Krishna be tied up? And he wasn't tied up for such a long time, and all day long Mother Yasoda was getting rope, more rope, and tying it all together, and Krishna refused to get tied up. And it's always two fingers too short. So it was remarkable, because Krishna wasn't getting any bigger. He's still the same size, and there's more rope. And so this is another achintya shakti. The rope was longer and longer and longer, but the distance never got shorter and shorter. And the Krishna was the same size. How is it possible? By normal logic, not possible. It always remained the same size, the lack, even though the rope got longer and longer and longer, and Krishna never got any bigger. So that's impossible. Krishna can do that. But then finally, Krishna got tied up. So why did he allow himself to get tied up? How is it possible? If he didn't want to get tied up, what changed his mind? Did he get tired? And then his shakti disappeared and suddenly got tied up? No, that cannot be also. So the answer is given that he saw Mother Yasoda was getting tired. After so many journeys to the house, and then she went to the neighbor's house and got more rope. It didn't work. Went to another neighbor's house, got more rope. And all afternoon she was running back and forth and trying to tie up Krishna, and she was getting very tired. And Krishna saw she's getting tired because she wants to tie me up. Originally he thought, I will not submit to Mother Yasoda because I want to play. I want to play with my friends. So I will not allow Mother Yasoda to tie me up at all. And so no matter how much rope she got, it wouldn't tie him up. And then she saw, he saw she's getting tired. And he had compassion for her. He saw that she's putting so much effort into trying to tie me up. And suddenly, got tied up. So what does that mean? The rope was always two fingers too short. So what the explanation is that if you want to tie up Krishna, if you want to bring Krishna under control, two things are necessary. Endeavor on the part of the devotee and mercy on the part of the Lord. So Mother Yasoda was endeavoring to tie up Krishna. That was her devotion because she was acting as a mother. And she was thinking, we must discipline Krishna because he's my son. And so that was not out of cruelty or acting as a judge or anything. It was because she was mother. And she felt as a duty as a mother, I have to train him up properly as a good boy. So that was very persistent. So persistent that all afternoon she was trying to tie up Krishna. But it didn't work. But she was getting tired. So, the devotee must have persistence in his endeavor to worship the Supreme Lord and please the Supreme Lord. And when that is there, then Krishna will be very compassionate to that devotee, because of course we know that prema brings Krishna under the control of the devotee. Prema controls Krishna, Krishna Karshani. Krishna becomes attracted to that prema and falls under the control of prema. So if the devotee expresses his love by doing his devotional service so intensely, then automatically Supreme Lord is moved and he will submit to the devotee's wishes. That's his mercy. So if the Lord's not merciful, then nothing happens. But if the devotee never does anything, no mercy. That's the normal case. Sometimes Krishna is extraordinary and he gives kripa, siddhi, without endeavor, like Putana or someone like that. But normally we have to do some work. In the case of Mother Yasoda, of course, she's not a conditioned soul. She's not doing sadhana bhakti anyway. She's on the supreme level. But even there, that same principle works according to your endeavor. In prema even, then Krishna responds. So when Krishna saw Mother Yasoda endeavoring so hard to do her duty as a parent, then he submitted to her. So God submits to the devotees, even though he is independent and above everyone. But that's so in all forms of God. God submits to the devotee to some degree, but it is extreme in Krishna, so therefore we'll see these examples of how Krishna gets tied up, and no other form of God gets tied up. But Mother Yasoda can do it. His servants will never dare to do that. His friends may do that sometimes. They defeat Krishna. And then Krishna gets punished. He has to carry them on the shoulder like that as a punishment because he loses. So Krishna does that for his friends. Krishna will submit to different types of devotees in different ways and come under their control. And with Krishna, this becomes very remarkable. So therefore, we'll see examples like Krishna being tied up by Mother Yasoda. In no other form also. So he plays this role exactly like a small child. But it is not simply an illusion or some sort of artificial thing, and actually he doesn't believe it. It's not some play acting. Krishna identifies completely here. And this is Krishna. And he's very, very attracted to his devotees. So that prema is never illusion. And Mother Yasoda's prema is not illusion. And Krishna's response to that prema because of his prema is not illusion. These are the most real things of all. And therefore Krishna acts in these different ways, performs these different actions. So in this way, Krishna is most human-like. Why? It's because his love is most intense for his devotees, and the devotees' love is most intense for Krishna. In that particular form of Vrindavan Krishna, that is the most human-like and most intense in its relationship. So much so that they are not aware that Krishna is even God. That is the intensity of their love. So here we find in this verse that Krishna is acting, not acting, but he's speaking, and he's talking like a normal person, and even according to the custom. So he's saying that actually one gets a body. One is born, we get a body, and the body has to get supported, etc. So who does this? The parents do that. The parents create the body. The mother has the child in the womb. Then the child is born from the mother. Then the mother must feed the child milk, otherwise it'll die. And then the father has to give protection, supply food, etc. like this. So in this way, the child from very conception upwards until it's grown up is under the protection of the parents. And this is normal life, and we'll see not only in human beings, it's also there in animals as well. The parents bring up the children, and when they're growing up, then they're independent. So this, of course, is codified in many societies, and there is this rule that one has to respect the parents and honor the parents, etc. Most old societies will find that in the world. Modern society is the opposite. But all the old societies are there, the traditional respect for the parents. Why? Because of this. Because the parents do a lot of work. In fact, their whole life is, more or less, their whole life is dedicated to raising children. Why does the father work all day? Because he has to make the money to support all the children and get them education, whatever, and whatever, whatever. And then all the mother and father are just doing this all their life, raising children. It's only for the children are doing all this. So naturally, there should be obligation. So this is expressed in the Varnashram system. There's runa. One has debt to different people. So one has debt to parents. one has debt to the devatas because they're responsible ultimately beyond the parents. The devatas in control of the body and the senses and whatever. So one has runa to the devatas. One has runa debts to the sages because they give the wisdom by which we can operate in this material world. So we have various runas. We have runas to the material elements, of course, because without the elements we don't have a body. And we have runa for the whole of society, because without that support of the society, we can't survive. So we have various levels of runa, or debts, to pay off to all these persons. So that is quite a strong tendency in the Varnashramic society, this idea of debt and paying back debt. One must show gratitude to these different persons because of all they've done for you. And that's why in the river they do the tarpanas. You'll see the people in the river pouring water like this. This is tarpanas. So they're offering their gratitude to the rishis and the devatas and the pitras, the parents and the previous generations of people that created your dynasty or your family lineage. This is all to show debt. Pay back the debt. We can't really pay back the debt in one sense because, the past ancestors are gone and they can't receive anything literally. But of course we know they're there somewhere because the souls are eternal and they take another body somewhere in Pitraloka or somewhere, or Svargaloka or somebody in this earth or wherever. And the devatas are there somewhere, we can't see them. And the rishis are there and we cannot see them. But they can receive whatever you offer, physically or mentally. They're not limited like us and we just get the actual things. They can get it through their... When you think of it and offer it with devotion, they get it. That's how they receive this. This is so daily people have to do their tarpanas, or monthly they do their tarpanas like this, to pay back their debts, so to speak. So this paying back of debt, of course, is not simply an obligatory custom or whatever. It becomes a ritual for many people. But actually, behind that is the idea that no body is independent in this material world, so we should recognize that fact. And ultimately, of course, then Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, you should do yajna, and ultimately you should worship me. Because above everybody, above the devatas and the material elements and all the different planets in the material world, above that is Supreme Lord. So we are ultimately indebted to Supreme Lord above everyone. And therefore, you worship Vishnu. But if we can't get such high ideas, then at least we go for the other ones, the lower ones in the material world, the devatas and the rishis and the pitras, etc. So all of them in the Varnashram system are worthy of worship. So what does that worship mean? That worship means, technically, not simply a ritual. It means that one respects properly. So that respect means love, in one sense. We show a loving relationship. And we show gratitude. Yes, we understand they've done something for us. So we show our feeling by offering that. Whatever. It's just water, usually. He's offering a little water. This idea of the love you're expressing for all these different personalities who are supporting you in this material world. So, we examine that, and actually it's a very good thing that we have to recognize that we are not independent like this. Now, of course, as I said, the ultimate thing is we should recognize Supreme Lord. So, Bhagavatam says, if you abandon all of your varnashramic duties, including your tarpanas and offerings to your rishis and ancestors and mother and father, etc., and you only worship the Supreme Lord, there's nothing wrong with that. No sin is incurred. If you abandon your rituals and you don't worship the Supreme Lord, yes, you are sinful. You will have to... But if you worship the Supreme Lord and you devote yourself and you fail to get the goal immediately, still, there is no debt incurred and no sin incurred by not offering that worship. So ultimately then, the final goal is Supreme Lord. We do that, covers all the other debts, etc. So anyway, here Krishna is expressing this regular Varnashramic principle that one should respect. The body is coming from the mother and father, etc., and therefore we have this debt to pay to the parents. But of course it's not just parents, it's parents, devatas, rishis, etc. So, just normal custom in the Varnashramic system. So he says, even if I live for 100 years, I cannot repay that debt. So this creates a little bit of a problem, of course, because that means that we're always debtors going throughout our life trying to pay back debts to the rishis and the parents, etc., etc. And then it goes on to the next lifetime and the next lifetime because we get born again and then we have to do the same thing. So we're caught up in this type of debt. So this is part of the cycle of karma in one sense. But this is more or less the good karma. If we pay back the debts, we get good karma for that. That's punya. If we neglect it, it's a sin. And therefore we suffer in future lives. So both things are there. The neglect means sin, and the performance means punya. And then we get more. It's not spiritual, of course. It's material. The Varnashram speaking is for artha, dharma, kama, and then finally moksha. So moksha is the last thing. So this is the artha dharma part, artha dharma kama part, where the body gets taken care of and we live peacefully in this material world. So why would Krishna have to speak all this sort of thing? We're not devotees. They're not even interested. They're pure devotees of the Lord. They're Nityasiddha devotees. They're not even the material body. And Krishna's not a material body. But he's speaking like this. Just like a normal child, normal person in the material world, with debts, etc. So Krishna has no debt. And if one worships Krishna, one has no debts to anybody. Yet Krishna is saying, I'm indebted to you. I have my duties to you for a whole lifetime, and I cannot repay. This is the nature of Krishna in his expression of love. He's a normal person in this material world, but he's not. It's simultaneous. So this is what is inconceivable about Krishna. So we should not think that Krishna is also pretending. No. He has this feeling for his great devotees, for his mother and father. I am indebted to you. I cannot repay the debt to you. And we see that with the gopis also. I cannot repay you, Krishna says to the gopis. I cannot repay you in any way. Because you have sacrificed what I cannot sacrifice. You have surrendered what I cannot surrender. You have given up your parents and the respect for all dharma. And you've given up their husbands and their children to come to the forest when Krishna played his flute. I will not give up my parents. I can never give up Mother Yasoda and Nanda. I will never reject them. I cannot do so. I cannot do like you do. I don't have a wife anyway, so I don't have to give her up. So you sacrifice more than I've done, so I cannot repay you. Krishna is saying this to the gopis. I am internally indebted to you. So how can God do that? But yet, this is Krishna. He has such love for them that he becomes the slave of the gopis. So this is the nature of the Lord's kingdom. And then he's saying, oh, I've failed. I'm hopeless. And especially because he didn't give them the chance to the association when he was young. For 10 and a half years, Vasudeva and Devaki were separate from Krishna. It's my fault. So this is the nature of Krishna. Now we have to understand this is Devaki and Vasudeva. And he has this love for them. So how much more love he must have for Yasoda and Nanda? And that, of course, is shown later on. So he doesn't leave them. And they're sitting in Vrindavan, and they're suffering. And Krishna's with the people of Mathura there, and Vasudeva and Devaki. So it looks as if, whoa, he prefers them. So that's, of course, the show in one sense, because he's both places at once later on. But later on, when everyone went to Kurukshetra, and then the inhabitants of Vrindavan, and Mother Yasoda, and Nanda Maharaj, and all the gopis, and all the cowherd boys, and they all went to Vrindavan, or to Kurukshetra, just to see Krishna, because they knew he'd be there. So when they went there, and then Nanda and Yasoda met Krishna privately in one of the tents there that was set up. And Rohini was there, and Vahi was there. And they were watching as Mother Yasoda and Nanda welcomed Krishna, and they put Krishna and Balaram on their laps. And milk was flowing from Mother Yasoda's breast, and she was crying, and Nanda was crying, and they're embracing Krishna and Balaram as their small children, even though they're, you know, grown up, they're very big. And they saw them as their small children, and they were crying and crying and crying like that. And Krishna is responding just like a small child to them. And Rohini and Devaki were there, and they were rather surprised. And they tried to speak, and Mother Yasoda never heard them. And Devaki will say, well, actually, Krishna's my child. Yes, we are indebted to you because you raised them like this, whatever. But Mother Yasoda never heard that. And then she realized that the love of Mother Yasoda and Nanda is much greater than our love for Krishna. The intensity of their love was so great. I do not have such a love as they have. And they realized that, and they left. They left the tent. So even Vasudeva and Devaki realized the intensity of love of Yasoda and Nanda was even greater, much, much, much greater than that. So if Krishna expresses this with Vasudeva and Devaki, how much more he will show his love for Nanda and Yasoda at all times. Anyway, any question?
Krishna promised the residents of Vrindavan that he was I'm assuming, I don't know whether it's correct, that one of the reasons why he didn't return was because he felt obliged to Vasudeva and Devaki and the residents of the Yadu dynasty to fulfill his obligations to them.
And here he's saying, the first years, I was absent for 10 years, and you never got the association. You couldn't feed me as a baby, all this. So, you know, so he's obliged to stay with them for some time.
But then the love of the residents of Vrindavan is greater than the others, yet he didn't go back.
So we explain that. So, yes, it is contradictory. To the gopis, I'll come back. And he promised to Nanda Maharaj, he sent him back from Mathura after several days and says, Balaram and I will have to stay here a few days because these are our relatives and mother and father, Vasudeva and Devaki are here, so we have to satisfy them for some time. Then we will come back after a few days. So you go back now. So then Nanda Maharaj and all the cowherd men and the cowherd boys went back because Krishna made a promise and he promised the gopis also. So they weren't worried. So that's why otherwise they wouldn't go back. If Krishna said, I'm not coming back, then they wouldn't have left him. But they went back. So Vishnu Chakravarti says, so it is a little bit contradictory if Krishna makes these promises, I'll be back in 5 days or 6 days or whatever, and he never comes back for 100 years, and then goes to the idea of Krishna, he promises I'll be back, and he's Vrindavan again, and he doesn't show up. Well, this sounds disastrous. How can Krishna break his promises when Krishna's satyavak tells the truth? Every word is truth. So how can he distort things like this? And of course, then we could say, well, yes, Krishna sent back Uddhava, and Uddhava says, well, you meditate on me. So what satisfaction the gopis are going to have in becoming yogis and seeing the Lord in the heart? They're not interested in Vishnu and the Lord in the heart at all. They want Krishna. So how is it that Krishna's simply satisfying them and telling them, I can meditate on me in the heart, and that's the same thing? No, it's not the same thing. So that is why Vishnu Chakravarti says that he should go back. So after 3 months of separation, to show the inhabitants of Mathura that the inhabitants of Vrindavan are much greater because of the intensity of their love, which is shown only in prolonged separation. After showing that intensity of love, then Krishna fulfilled his promise and he went back. Maybe a little late, 3 months later, not a few days, but he went back. How did he go back? He had two forms. One stayed in Mathura to satisfy the people there, and he also had to kill all the demons because that was his purpose. He had to satisfy the devatas, and Krishna had come to kill all the demons on earth and arrange for the battle of Kurukshetra, etc. So he had to do that also. So he had to stay with the people of the Shastra. And he was also born in the Vrishni family, so he had to satisfy everybody. He had to satisfy mother, Vasudeva and Devaki, be their child also, because they had prayed, let us have the Lord as our son. So he had to satisfy them also. But he had to keep his promise to the Vrajavasis. So which promise is greater? They're all devotees, but of all people, he can never disobey his promise to the, or break his promise to the Vrajavasis, because they're the greatest devotees. So he had to go back. That's the ultimate conclusion. So therefore, Vishnu and Shakyamuni, he went back in another form. One form stayed in Mathura, one form went back. But then if he went back, how come the Vrajavasis are still there after 20 or 30 years of moaning and groaning on the separation? And so he says, because there are two forms of Vrajavasis. There are two forms. One form is the one we see. They are in separation for so many years. And Krishna is in Dwarka. The other form, Krishna's back with the devotees and they're enjoying their pastimes forever. And Krishna goes on Rasa every night. And this goes on forever. We don't see that. It's uppercut. But it goes on. And then all the devotees are there. Nanda Yasoda are there in that form also. And they're feeding Krishna every day. Krishna goes out in the fields every day with the cowherd boys and tends the cows. And goes on. And by the remarkable energy of the Supreme Lord, his Yogamaya potency, the two forms don't collide in any way. And one is not aware of the other, even though they're the same person. So you have two sets of Mother Yasoda, Nanda, and everybody else. One form of separation and one form in meeting. That's all problem. And of course, Krishna, when he went to Kurukshetra, when he says, I will return, at that time, the separation forms, when they met him, then he said, okay, you go back to Vrindavan again, and I will come back again. Yeah, so then Krishna went back to Dwarka. He said, I have to kill a few demons. So Krishna killed a few demons. The last demon he killed was Dantavakra. So after he killed Dantavakra, he was free. Yeah, so it is said in Padma Purana that when he killed Dantavakra, he did that near Mathura. And after killing him, then he crossed the river, or bathed in the river, Jamuna. And then he went to Vrindavan. And he met everybody, and everyone was joyful. And then, as they called the Kutha. So what does that mean? How do they go to Vaikuntha? They should go to Goloka. So actually they went to Aishwarya Goloka, one form. And there's two parts of Goloka. And Krishna has two different forms there also in the spiritual world. One part is the part we know here with Krishna and everybody, and they don't see him as God. That's the regular Gokul. And surrounding that, then we have another Krishna, the same cowherd boy, etc., but they worship him with awe and reverence. That's the Aishwarya Goloka. So one, those forms all had merged when Krishna performed his pastimes here, and then those parts he sent them back to the Aishwarya Goloka. And the Vrindavan Krishna, the Gokul Krishna with all the inhabitants, they went into Uppercut Leela on earth in Vrindavan. And another form went back to Dwarka again. Then, four pastimes like this.
Krishna says that his devotee will never perish. Mm-hmm. And yet, we do see the devotees in situations where the at least material body is. And I've heard it explained that protection is from the separation, not for their material bodies, but rather they're protected from the feelings of separation from Krishna.
And
Krishna appears. And I also heard that the feelings of separation, which is considered to be the highest. Is sucked in their separation, Krishna actually manifests before them.
That's another point.
Lord Chaitanya becomes so absorbed in separation that he actually sees Krishna.
So, that's also there. Vishnu Chakravarti explains that in that separation, there is one form, it's called a spurti. in that separation, the intensity of their love becomes so great that Krishna actually appears in one form. But then, the other thing is, after this separation, Krishna does appear directly also. So there's two things. And when the devotee's in a separation, doesn't mean it's eternal. Krishna always resolves that by coming to them. So he doesn't prolong it too long. You know, after some time, the devotee meets Krishna again. And in the meantime, the love of Krishna appears in their mind. And they will satisfy some degree. But still, it's not the same thing for them. So then Krishna directly appears before them also. And the other question was about the first part?
The protection.
Well, obviously, for the sadhaka siddhas or whatever, or the people who are sadhakas, they do have bodies. And though Krishna, by his extraordinary energy, could maintain those bodies for a long time or whatever, usually he doesn't do that. And they are subject to destruction like the normal bodies of this material world. So Baladeva Vidyabhusan says that we should not think the devotees are karma, then just be murdered directly. But the Supreme Lord, his body, he makes it follow the regular rules of this world like karma, as if it were karma and that you die and you get sick and you die, whatever. Just to show that the law of karma doesn't accept anybody. But actually it's not under, it's only a resemblance to karma. And he says it's like the singeing of a cloth. If we take a piece of silk cloth, raw silk, and we stick it near the fire, we don't burn it actually, we just put it very close and it dries out very nicely and we make it real dry, real close, and then we take it away. It looks like silk cloth. But if you touch it, it crumbles away. Yeah. So that is like a semblance of silk. So in the same sense, we have a semblance of karma. For the book of the semblance of karma going on for the pure devotee in the material world is actually a... But it's not karma. It's an appearance of karma only. And the devotee, of course, is separate from material body, so he doesn't suffer.
That means then we don't have to go to astrologers to find out what we should do next. We should follow the order of the guru and accept the reactions.
Well, as Bhagavatam says, the devotee actually... the devotee who was to earn the mercy of the Supreme Lord and become a rightful claimant of the Lord's mercy, he accepts his karmas as the mercy of the Lord and is not disturbed by them. And he says, this is what's happening. And he continues his devotional service steadily. In other words, he's not disturbed by it in any way. Of course, the other point is that through devotional service, all karma is destroyed. Parabdha and aparabdha. All the future karmas and all the karmas coming up in this present birth or life, they're all destroyed by the process of bhakti. Unfortunately, we can't destroy them all at once. It's a gradual process. So we're still getting karmas on us as we progress in devotional service all the way up to bhava stage. Destruction is taking place, but gradually it's taking place also. So the devotee also isn't really limited by karmas. By performance of devotional service, that will all disappear. So the possibilities of what a devotee can do are become very, very great, because he's not limited to the same degree as a normal person. We shouldn't consider a devotee in terms of varna and ashrama, because those are limitations according to birth. So he goes beyond the gunas, he goes beyond all this gradually by performance of bhakti. So in other words, the possibility of doing, he can do anything in this material world, in one sense, as he becomes more and more elevated, the karmas and the gunas and all the limitations get destroyed. So he becomes free.
Before Krishna could have there was a question of the inheritance of Vrindavan meeting Krishna.
No, that, so one form remained in separation. One form that we see is Mish all time. So that separation form met Krishna in Kurukshetra. And then later, Krishna met them and took them to the Aishwarya Goloka. And then the other form, that that state in Vrindavan, apricot again, and we can't see that form. And they're still there. I think Vishnu Chakravarti says that. And some people, even today, they can see them performing their pastimes there. Yeah, so they're there still, apricot.
In the case of Devaki and Raimi Maharaji, Maharaji showed his love and they
yeah.
It seems like they might become sad and depressed if they have one to do
that. When they see this, Uddhava, when he saw the love of the inhabitants of Vrindavan, then he prays, let us have love like that. But then we can say, well, how can Uddhava, who's in Dasya Rasa, aspire for a different rasa of Vatsalya Rasa or Madhurya Rasa, the gopis? It sounds weird. It's ridiculous. So Vishnu Chakra does explain that, no, they're not aspiring for a different rasa. They're just aspiring, let us also have intense love within Dasya Rasa in our particular way. Yeah, we would hope to have such intense love there, that's all. So they become inspired. We don't have love. Let us also have such intense love. That is what when they see the inhabitants of Vrindavan, that is the impression they get. And then they respect that inhabitant because they're all love. But in this, obviously, among Nitya Siddhas world, there is no envy like that. We have to defeat that person and take their place and get Krishna's love. Because Krishna satisfies everybody.
Yeah,
your education and whatever to your parents, sending your money and everything.
Sam, you mentioned that if they worship Krishna, there's no debt to anybody.
Yeah, yeah.
But then
that's of course a subtle debt. So you have a debt to pay back the government.
My question was, isn't it like it's only for like very, very advanced devotees that that doesn't hold true, or like, you know, for general kind of devotees who are just coming along and you know, practicing, like they have to hold these.
Oh,
I mean,
well.
So they can't just say, oh, because I
yeah. Well, in
one round, so that's it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, obviously one has to be dedicated. That is, if one really dedicates oneself to the Supreme Lord, then that holds.
Exactly.
Yeah. It doesn't mean that I'm just using it as an excuse to stop everything and do one little fraction of a worship of Krishna. Now I don't have to do anything. No, one actually has to dedicate oneself to the Supreme Lord. Krishna's sovereign Lord. That doesn't mean you just give up everything and worship Krishna. Little means you completely dedicated, you know, body, mind, words, everything to Krishna. And therefore you give up everything.
What are the debts to the rishis that you mentioned?
Knowledge. They give knowledge to us. Scripture, things, acharyas, you can say parampara, everybody. Yeah.
What about, is it appropriate for a devotee to feel some indebtedness to his parents? In the fact that they've given us the opportunity, the body, and then once there's the opportunity to also do devotional service.
And
so therefore, when it's time for them to considering give them an opportunity to make some spiritual.
Yeah, that's nothing wrong with that. It's a type of preaching in one sense. And by making them favorable, at least, even if they don't become devotees, they're favorable. It's just like when one becomes a devotee, then one liberates all of one's, you know, 14 generations or whatever. That's how it more or less works, because if we can make them favorable, then definitely they get a good advantage. Even if they don't become favorable, but they're not real aparatis or anything like that, they do get advantage because everything's related to everything, and because your body's produced and your body became the body of a devotee, everything in the past contributed to that, so it's like a gata sukriti for everybody in that line. And if somebody's a little bit of themselves, they're a devotee, so maybe next lifetime they become a devotee. So everything you can do to make them favorable, more favorable, is good also. It's like a gata sukriti, more or less, whatever.
It's interesting Prabhupada says that there's no need to take sannyas if your family members are not an obstacle to devotional service.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
If they are an obstacle, then give them up.
Yeah.
So, you know, if your family members are quite favourable, then it would. I mean, you could be another Christian and say, okay,
yeah.
I'm a devotee, I don't have to look after them and I'll get the benefit. You say, okay, I'm a devotee, let's maximise the benefit for them by putting some time into looking after them at the time of death.
Because
they'll be thinking about it.
Of course, one of the angas of bhakti is do not disturb any living entity. So we should try not to unnecessarily aggravate parents or anything like that.
I think so.
Yeah, it says prani matra. Any prani, any living entity, one should not disturb. That's the 20th anga of bhakti.
Should disturb anybody.
Yeah. You know, look in Nectar Devotion there, the 64 angas. Number 20 is don't disturb anybody, any living entity. So what to speak of the devatas, don't offend the devatas. And I guess it applies to the rishis and the parents and everybody else. You try to, you know, keep things peaceful as much as possible.
What about the demons? I mean, there are some people who say that they
don't avoid demons. Yeah.
Distribution means approaching demons or disturbing.
Yeah. Well, we have to take a chance. If we do, then we more or less avoid them when we find out they are demons, and we try to get the don't waste our time on the demons, and you know, approach the innocent people or the favorable people. Don't try to force them into anything, you know, like that. That's what. Same thing is there, same Krishna is there, same type of relationship is there, except this, and Krishna is a cowherd boy, but they all recognize Krishna, and there's more or less, they worship him in reverence. And he's more or less kind of kingly, like, you know, he's riding on his chariot sometimes and whatever like that. So there's a little reserve there, which is not in Gokul. So it is something almost like Dwarka in one sense, but not so regal as Dwarka, because he's still a cowherd boy. But as in Dwarka, they see him also as Krishna, but he is also God. So in Aishwarya Goloka, he is cowherd boy Krishna, but they also worship him like God.
What's his relationship with Radharani?
It's like, just like in Dwarka, he has all these queens. So there's Madhurya Rasa there also, but they recognize, all the queens recognize Krishna as God also, simultaneously. So they're gopis, but they also see him as God, so there's reverence in their relationship with Madhurya Rasa.
So they might see as cheeky.
Yeah. Yeah, there's reverence there, so obviously all the particular rasas won't manifest in the same way.
There's also a Vaikuntha planet with Radha Krishna worship, is that correct? Formed of Radha Krishna.
Vaikuntha, I don't know about that. I think the Aishwarya Goloka is the place. We can say it's a different planet in one sense. Actually, it's a suburb or something of Gokul, but I've never heard of another planet besides that.
Is it Skatriya or Varakiya?
Well, Vishwanath doesn't really say, but it may be Swakya. I don't know, though. Yeah, it's not quite clear as far as no details are really given on that. Future generations? Or past? What's it? Past or future? What's it? Oh, well, what does it say? Does it say past and future? Yeah. Well, you see, obviously, that's a statement we can't take literally, that suddenly everyone gets liberated or will be liberated. Like, that's just like saying the descendants of the Goswamis are the descendants of the Goswamis are all pure devotees when we know some of them aren't, you know, like that. So, yeah, what it means is obviously you get a chance and you got a Sukriti and whatever. So, you're definitely on the path, and as long as you don't commit aparads. And eventually you will get, you know. Once the Agata Sukriti starts to build up that, you get out. I don't know. Both, maybe. Both, because they both contribute. Doesn't actually say, but is that from the mother's side or the father's side, which was 14 generations? Well, I would say both sides, because they both contribute, obviously.
A devotee's karma is orchestrated by Krishna.
Well, destroyed, actually.
Destroyed by Krishna?
Yeah. Well, by bhakti. Yeah.
There's that quotation in the Chaitanya Charitamrita where Lord Chaitanya says, the quotes, I think it's from Bhagavatam, that when a devotee takes possession of Krishna, it's just dull.
Yeah.
So, what happens, sometimes we see devotees have difficulties, and even they may engage in breaking our regulated things.
Yeah.
So, can we say that's also orchestrated by Krishna?
Could break the principles?
Yeah.
Well, when Krishna says
some difficulty, they may get overwhelmed. Basically, they keep doing their devotional service.
Yeah.
But there is turbulence, so we say.
Okay.
And then moving forward in Krishna consciousness.
Yeah.
So, the devotee is supposed to see the reactions that they get, and maybe even the reactions are so severe that they may be impelled to act. Yet they're still chanting, they're still following, they're trying to do their service, they're still planning to do How can that still would also be seen as Krishna's arrangement?
No, actually, this is an art and a vritti. Yeah? There's still the influence of impressions and karmas and all this, and present, desires, etc., acting. Yeah, so they still have that, and the process of bhakti is getting rid of them, but some of them are still there.
Yeah.
And to the extent that we are good at our devotional service, we destroy more. If we're lax at our service, we get less, so we have more problems. Mm-hmm. And if we have more problems to begin with, of course, those will continue also. And if we commit aparad, then even slower progress, or maybe no progress at all. So then we get more souls. Our thing is destroyed, and then all the karmas come up, and all the desires are there. Whatever extent the bhakti is sincere, then something's going to happen that'll start destroying the karmas. Yeah? And of course, Krishna sometimes extraordinary mercy is there, so he may show extra kripa to some people also, and make things easier also. But some devotees, some people have more severe karmas than others to begin with, so those will continue. And as you do devotional service, it goes away. But other persons may not have such severe karmas, so they won't have difficulty in those persons because those karmas weren't there to begin with.
That's good for them.
No, because karma itself, the idea of karma, is there not to punish us, but to show us our mistakes and to learn from the mistakes to correct ourselves. That's actually what karma is for, only.
Yeah.
And once we correct ourselves, karma's gone. You don't have to suffer the karma anymore once we correct ourselves. So that's why I said that Bhagavatam says that the real devotee then, he sees his karmas as mercy of the Lord. It's not direct mercy, of course, but it's just that he realizes that this is the mercy of the Lord, so that I can understand that these are my past activities, and therefore this is the result now, therefore I got to stop doing this. Yeah, and this is bad for me, so therefore I better tame my desires. Yeah, so unless we learn what to do with our desires, not create activities, activities create karmas, karmas create suffering. Huh? That's the sequence. Yeah? So if we don't like our present karmas, what's happening to us now, we've got to change the desires. Which, two things. One is, change our desires, well, everyone wants to enjoy in the material world, so I'm suffering now, so let me enjoy. It's not so simple as that. It's how you enjoy also. So you may have wanted to enjoy in your last lifetime, but you're suffering now. Why? Because you took it in the wrong, you did the sinful activity to enjoy. Huh? So then you have to, if you still want to enjoy, then you have to think of a different way of doing it. Without sin. So in other words, we avoid the sin and we do the opposite. So that means the punya. That's, of course, material, but we have no simple voluntary. We do the opposite. If we, then we also do the charity and the whatever on the material level. Of course, if we're devotees, then we do bhakti, which is higher, and that solves all the problems. It's the highest charity, giving to Krishna.
That can be confusing for devotees because they want to be a devotee, but then they discover that they want to do other things as well. Hang on a second, I want to be a devotee.
Yeah.
And then how come I have a carrying all this non-devotional karma?
Oh, well, that's because it's a continuation from the previous lifetime, and through bhakti, you have to get rid of it. So that's why we emphasize pure bhakti. We have to realize this obstacle to get out there. So then we're doing sudha bhakti, even though we're not pure. We explicitly don't want to give it up, and we're trying to do them both together, and it's called mixed bhakti. Yeah, karma, misra bhakti.
What about some of the impact of seeing boy devotees that brings shame onto other devotees? The impact of sin brings unregulated behavior that, I know I got in trouble when I began practicing, for example, for smoking a cigarette whilst being out in front of crossways and looking like Hare Krishna. That's a pretty big deal in the eyes of some people, and in my own eyes, I'm not accepted that now. I'm aware of much more serious unwanted behaviors in the past that have brought great shame on the movement. Those sorts of things, I wonder, can you say, can you elaborate on the impact of the comparison of those sorts of behaviors?
Oh, well, yeah, sinful behavior is not good. It's sinful, and you get a reaction for it. But worse than that is aparad. That means to actually offend devotees and to think badly of devotees, to criticize devotees, or criticize Krishna and whatever. That's worse. Yeah? Sinful activity, okay, that's an obstacle, but worse than that is aparad. Now, the two may also combine, but maybe sinful and also aparadi at the same time. That's what happens. Yeah? Should we end there? Not yet. Okay, we'll do that now because that's the time.
I'm just going to check the match.
Okay. Yeah. This is disappearance.
Disappearance.
Yeah. Okay. So this is disappearance day of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. So as everybody knows, he is the spiritual master of our founder, Acharya A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. And, of course, he was the prominent son of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Was also famous acharya, great writer, great preacher, bhakti, and probably the person who is responsible for reviving Goa's pride in this century, 20th century. And so Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur took up that same spirit of preaching and communicating the pure teachings of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to the world. Not only that, but he was quite a practical person, and therefore he established centers all over India and even had the vision of expanding around the world. So he sent people to different places. He sent them to England. He sent people to Burma to do preaching work on behalf of Lord Chaitanya's movement. So he was a very enthusiastic preacher of Lord Chaitanya's mission and a great visionary as well. He was a great fighter. At that time, in the first part of this, or previous century, 20th century, first part of the 20th century, there were many problems in the Sampradaya from all sources, from the traditional sources and from the non-traditional heretical sources. There were all sorts of problems in our Sampradaya. After Lord Chaitanya, the immediate followers carried on the movement, but after several generations, there were some heretical split, so to speak, theoretical contrary doctrines appearing called apasampradayas, of which we have maybe about 7 different types. Philosophically, different ideas, even though they said they were devotees of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So we have that type of thing coming out. The Sahajiyas and the Atavadis and the Gauranagaris and the Saki Bekis and the Owls and the Bowls and whatever. They all showed, you know, respect for Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as they were followers, but their philosophy and their conduct was completely different from what Lord Chaitanya taught. So these also continued, and some of them became very strong. So that was one thing. The other thing is the traditional lines coming from the great devotees of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, like Advaita's line, or let's say Srivas Pandit's line, or the pujaris in the temples in Vrindavan of the Goswami's temples. They were obviously not married there, so they had many grihasthas, and they had children, and they became the Goswamis of the temples. And in Bengal, the people, Janava's line, etc., was more or less, they were grihasthas, and they carried on lines of acharyas there, gurus, Goswamis, and got different copies here and there, and then finally made an authorized edition of it after all that, and published it. So that's when, of course, publication came in with the British, and Bhaktivinoda Thakur began to publish things, and he began to write also. So those things were going on, and Bhaktivinoda Thakur fought against all the aprasampradayas and established the correct teachings and wrote works in Sanskrit and Bengali. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur also, he was obviously influenced by Bhaktivinoda Thakur because he was a son, and he was... Bhaktivinoda took him to different things, like he would tour the different holy places and things, and hears lectures, hears discussions with other devotees. So he was greatly influenced by that. He, of course, was also very intelligent, brilliant on his own. And when he was quite a young boy, maybe 12 or 14, he was proficient in astronomy, mathematics, and things like that. And so he got the title of Siddhanta Saraswati from that. Siddhanta referring, of course, to the Siddhanta texts in astronomy, like Surya Siddhanta and Siddhanta Siromani, Sanskrit texts on, you know, calculating the movements of planets and eclipses and things like that. So he got that title because of his proficiency in that. So he was logically quite proficient due to mathematical abilities. He also invented his own language, alphabet. Just for fun of it, I suppose, he invented his own language as well. So he was very, very intelligent. But at a certain stage, he decided it's a waste of time. He just rejected that material education. And for some time, he was a librarian in some library in Tripura or something like that. And then he decided to devote himself completely just to bhakti after that point. And he developed great, great knowledge of all different shastras, not only the Gaudiya shastras, but Vedic literature in general. He developed great knowledge. And then at a certain point, then he began to preach. He was really disgusted with the situation of the Sampradaya. So he took a vow to chant so many, I don't know, millions of rounds or something like that. And for several years he was sitting in Mayapur in a little kutir, chanting and chanting and chanting and chanting and chanting, just chanting japa like that. And he was so disgusted with everything. And then after that, he took sannyas from himself and then started the Gaudiya Math. And then he developed followers there. Soon after that, he started getting a following. And he established the mutt there in Mayapur and then Calcutta, like that. And he got very intelligent people following. Some were grihasthas, they supported financially. And then he got many brahmacharis and sannyasis, which is a little rare because there was no such movement there. There were no, in the Gaudiya Sampradaya, they didn't have brahmacharis and sannyasis. They just had grihastha goswamis there, and people took initiation and went home. That was it. So he had mutts, ashrams, and then the ashrams he had the brahmacharis and sannyasis. So this was something very different. And no one really renounced before that time in the 19th century. There were not many renunciates in the Gaudiya Sampradaya. None, actually. So this was a little unique. So he established in Calcutta, and then he sent people off to other places, like Delhi and Bombay and Madras, major centers in India. They established centers there. And he also was lecturing and writing as well. And he had at one time, I think, three or four newspapers going. One was a daily newspaper, one was a weekly one, one was a monthly one. All these things going on at the same time, publications and newspapers. So very, very active in the preaching sphere. And always very direct. So he would attack the opposing parties and criticize and defeat them all. He wasn't too sweet-worded in many ways. He would directly, specify. So he developed many enemies also, many, many enemies because of that. And there were several attempts on his life, apparently. But nevertheless, he didn't care for that, and he was protected from that, and he went on with his preaching mission. So, of course, in the course of that preaching, then our founder of our movement, Srila Prabhupada, he met him, and he also became inspired by that same fire of preaching, and Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati told him to preach also. That was the main thing. You preach the message of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to the intelligent people of English-speaking language. So he took that as, finally Prabhupada took that as his mission, and then he started this movement, ISKCON. So the outstanding quality of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was this idea of continuing the preaching, the correct philosophy, and preaching that around the world. And he did that by establishing mutts in India and sending people out. He did that by his own personal preaching around India and by his writing. In this way, he established the Gaudiya Sampradaya quite firmly in the world. Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur, in some sense, made some sort of organization. Before that time, there wasn't much of an organization in the